Good morning, Dr. Ross.
Good morning, Brent. Lovely to talk to you, mate.
Lovely to talk to you as well, as always. I trust you well on this Saturday morning.
Yep. My old mate, Dr. James Wright, used to say, never seen it brighter.
Let's do a few listener questions. Roger says, 2 years ago, I had a knee replacement surgery on both knees. My left knee has been very painful with a feeling of extreme tightness. 3 follow-up x-rays and 2 scans have shown nothing amiss with the inserts. The doctors can't offer any treatment other than to have an explorative procedure which may or may not offer any answers. Does Dr. Walker have any suggestions? Thank you from Roger.
Yeah, Roger, I hear what you're saying. The problem with knee surgery, having had it myself, is that 90% are very successful and 10% are not. And the problem is, interestingly, obviously, in your case, one has been successful and the other one hasn't. If you're getting very tight and painful in the knee and they've done thorough evaluations, there's no infection, which is the big worry with a knee replacement. If you get an infection into that, there's no blood supply that goes to the joint because it's a mechanical joint. And the only thing you can do is remove the joint. So infection is the first thing you need to exclude. If that's excluded, it can't be anything else in terms of an arthritis, an inflammatory arthritis affecting that because your knee's been taken away. So you really have to consider what the doctors are saying about exploratory surgery. I wish there was some magic, but there is none.
Sorry, Roger, not good news. Adam is suffering from extreme pain down the right-hand side. His doctor sent him x-rays and CT scans, which showed no breaks. However, he has extreme arthritis. He's taking painkillers with minimal relief. Dr. Ross, is there anything that you can recommend?
Oh, yeah. If someone has that degree of pain, they really must be seeing a rheumatologist because if there is inflammatory arthritis, we now have all these wonderful disease-modifying agents that do help. But the first thing always in this sort of scenario is to make an accurate diagnosis because there's a whole host of different rheumatologic diseases that can cause pain. And the best way to sort that out is to have an expert who deals with this all the time, which is a rheumatologist. So firstly, get the diagnosis from a rheumatologist. And if the rheumatologist feels it is appropriate, he'll be put on disease-modifying agents. In the meantime, all you can do is just handle the pain with painkillers and some natural anti-inflammatories like curcumin and some omega-3. But that's not going to solve the problem. The problem is solved once the diagnosis is made.
Ian has previously suffered from type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. His doctor told him to stop taking Diformin 2 years ago. Since stopping, he's become extremely itchy. Is there a side effect of stopping the Diformin?
No, I think that's probably coincidental, but I don't know why his doctor did tell him to stop Diformin. His diabetes may have gone into remission because of lifestyle changes, but there's a lot of work on Diformin, which is otherwise known as Metformin. Metformin is now being studied around the world as an anti-aging drug. And even if you're not diabetic, some people are taking this as an anti-aging drug. Now, I will freely admit I tried to take it myself, but it upset my gut too much, so I couldn't take it. And about 10% of people who take any drugs will get side effects, and I got significant gastrointestinal side effects on the metformin. But the itchiness is due to something else. He needs to get that sorted out with his doctor, find out what it is, possibly be referred to a dermatologist. But firstly, just speak to the doctor about it and say, look, what else could this be? But it's got nothing to do with stopping a drug.
A little bit of deja vu here, Ross. Ray says, dear Brent and Ross, my wife missed the segment by Dr. Walker on Prolia used after 10 years. Loretta, that's his wife's name, has been on it long-term and wants to know the long-term effects and why she should stop using it. Could Dr. Walker just revisit that? It would be most appreciated.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, it's my knowledge that the endocrinologist is saying you should really only be on it for 7 years, no longer than that. Now, the reasons for saying this is that I think it probably loses its efficacy after that time. I'm not an endocrinologist. I'm not an expert in the whys and wherefores of Prolia, but I think 7 years is probably long enough to be on it, and I think it's probably better to vary your osteoporosis treatment. I think everyone who has osteoporosis should be doing exercise. I mean, we all should be doing exercise, but exercise is the best treatment for osteoporosis. Should be taking vitamin K2, which takes the calcium out of the arteries, puts it back in your bones, and have your vitamin D levels running around 100 and not take oral calcium. So they're the basic premises of the natural things you can do to help osteoporosis. But the best, I believe, the best medical treatment is Prolia. But I think with all of these things, 7 years is a good time to be on it, and then after that, reevaluate. Now, what's the long-term problem with staying on it forever? No one really knows. It hasn't been around for long enough to know if you were on it for, say, 20 years, that you might end up with some problems. But I just think it's safer to just leave it for 7 years and maybe switch to other therapies, because there are many therapies on the market for osteoporosis. It's just my feeling that Prolia is the best.
Timely, you're talking about exercise. David says, as we get older, maintaining fitness becomes more challenging. What are some of the most effective exercises for people over 60 to stay healthy and mobile?
That's a great question. And let me say that I think that as you get older, your exercise should become less intense. Now, one of my very good mates who's had a knee replacement has run, since his knee replacement, 4 or 5 marathons. Now, I tell him there's a perfectly good bus service. I just don't know why anyone would be doing that to their body, because he's going to wear his knee replacement out if he keeps doing this. So I just don't know why. What is it in his head that makes him do this? So I think once you get to the old fart stage, which is over the age of 65, especially, I'm certainly at that stage, I think the best exercise is an exercise bike or swimming. Now, the reason why I like an exercise bike, because swimming I find is very good for you, but I personally find it a bit boring. And I'm a lousy swimmer as well. But the exercise bike is terrific because you don't have to wear a helmet. You can't fall off your bike. No one can run into you. It doesn't matter what the weather's doing. You're not breathing in other cars' pollution. So even though cycling is good for you, often cycling involves roads and other cars and drivers who can run into your bike and you have an accident. And the good thing about an exercise bike, as opposed to a treadmill, is that you can push the exercise bike to your level, whereas the treadmill tells you how fast you should be going depending on the speed and the slope of the treadmill. And also, it's not as vicious on your knees and your hips if you use an exercise bike or swim as opposed to walking or a treadmill or jogging. And the interesting thing is that the day before my knee replacement, I did 20 Ks on my exercise bike, but I couldn't walk up and down the stairs. So I think an exercise bike's a terrific thing, but I think all exercise in anyone should be about 3 to 5 hours a week. It should be 2/3 cardio, i.e. the exercise bike or swimming, or if you want to, playing tennis, playing golf, cycling, jogging, whatever, and 1/3 resistance training. So I think that all of us should be having some sort of weight training, yoga, Pilates, something to keep your muscles strong, as well as keeping the cardiovascular system working well.
Ross, question from me in reference to exercise. Obviously, as you would be aware, I'm a regular exerciser, or try to be a regular exerciser.
Your body's a machine.
It used to be. Now, look, how important, not just cardio, not just some weight-bearing exercise, but how important is stretching?
I think stretching is important. I don't think it's vital, but it just, especially if you're going to do exercise, it's good to stretch some things. So, because if you go into some exercise cold, you can actually snap tendons. And I say, well, once you get over 50, the only joint you blow is your hip or your knee. But you can also snap tendons to do a whole lot of other things. So a bit of stretching before you exercise is a good thing.
Fiona has this question, and she refers to something that we talked about last week.
Yep.
Fiona says, I'm 66 years old and have low-grade lower back pain. Most days I can put up with it, but every now and then it puts me out of action for a couple of days. Am I best to carry on and put up with it, or should I go and see someone?
No, I think if you're getting recurrent low back pain, it's good to get some therapies for it. So I have a similar thing, and probably every 3 to 6 months mine will go as well if I lift something a bit too heavy or just go a bit hard at the exercise. And so what I do every day is weights and stretching for my back, because there are a lot of stretching on the back and just moving around. So things like yoga, Pilates are very good for low back pain. One of the worst things you can do when you have low back pain is nothing. So getting up and moving around is actually good for your back, but pushing yourself too hard is not. So having things like regular massage, osteopathic work on your back, physiotherapy on your back certainly may help. A thing that I do every week, there's a colleague of mine who has a handheld device called a MedKey, And this Medcare delivers electromagnetic pulses into the back. I think that's a good thing to do. If people are having a lot of problems with their back after having done all the things that I've said, in terms of discomfort, there is some benefits potentially from using medical cannabis. But the problem with medical cannabis is it is difficult to get. You've got to jump through a lot of hoops to get it. And also it appears that many of the doctors prescribing medical cannabis are being watched very carefully by the medical board and the health compliance department. So I think there's a few issues there, but if you do have low back pain, please have someone who can supervise your management.
Let's do a couple of topics. Gene therapy is a hopeful new approach for treating eye diseases that can cause vision loss. It works by introducing healthy genes to replace faulty ones.
Yep.
But it still has some challenges, such as side effects and how to deliver the treatment effectively, Ross.
Yeah, see, the problem with gene therapy is that are you going to have an effect on the global genome? Now, the good thing about the eyes is the eyes are pretty separate from the rest of the genome. So if you inject gene therapy directly into the eyes, it shouldn't penetrate out of the eyes into other tissues and cause problems. So that's one of the advantages there. And what they're doing with gene therapy is they're attaching the therapy that they want to introduce. So the new genes, the new healthy genes they want to introduce into people who have unhealthy genes via particular types of viruses. So either an adenovirus or a thing called a lentivirus, or even a thing called an adeno-associated virus. And these are the great viral vectors for retinal diseases of the eyes. Now, interestingly, there are two groups of retinal diseases. There's the relatively uncommon inherited retinal diseases, diseases that most people haven't heard of before, retinitis pigmentosa, choroideremia, Leber congenital amaurosis, all of these different things. In fact, there are now 200 clinical trials underway worldwide to introduce functional copies of these mutated genes in these relatively uncommon conditions. But here's the big kicker here, Brent. In terms of acquired retinal diseases, now tell me if you haven't heard of these ones, glaucoma, age-related macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy. We're talking millions and millions of people around the world are getting problems with visual impairment because of these conditions, and they're starting to talk about using gene therapy for these very common conditions. So at the moment, say for example with glaucoma, you can have surgical procedures, drops into the eyes, age-related macular degeneration if it's dry, there are just some supplements that might give you some reasonable relief. If it's wet, you can have injections into your eyeballs once a month, which does give some relief. Diabetic retinopathy, they can use laser therapy for this. But just imagine if we get gene therapy to the point where it is working, it is sophisticated, where we can give people back their vision, because they have used gene therapy in some people, especially with the inherited diseases, where they've actually been able to restore a degree of reasonable vision for people who can hardly see at all.
A study from the University of Sydney found that having multiple surgeries may lead to slight cognitive decline in older adults. Analysing data from nearly 500,000 people aged 40 to 69 over 20 years, researchers discovered that each additional surgery can slow reaction times, reduce memory, and affect problem-solving skills.
Absolutely. And the particular subset of this study, so it's a thing called the UK Biobank, which is being used by researchers all over the world because the comprehensive data of, as you say, 500,000 people aged between 40 to 70 with a very long follow-up. And this subset looked at just under 47,000 people who'd all had MRIs and detailed cognitive testing and found that there was a link between the more surgeries they'd had, or the longer the anesthesia, and the more problems with changes on the MRI and also problems with neurocognitive testing. So the bottom line of this message really is make sure whatever surgery you have over the age of 65 is necessary, because unnecessary surgeries can really lead to issues. So I'll give you one great example in my specialty in cardiology. There's a technique called ablation for atrial fibrillation. Now, this ablation for atrial fibrillation can take up to 3 hours of general anesthesia. Now, we have medications that are quite effective for the same condition but don't require a general anaesthetic. So I think if you say a 50-year-old with atrial fibrillation, go in and have the ablation. But if you're 75, I'd really reserve that anaesthetic unless the atrial fibrillation had no other avenue for treatment.
What did you say? Ablation for atrial fibrillation?
Yeah, and that's a procedure that's done through the vein in the groin, and you introduce a catheter into the vein, and you maneuver it up through into the heart, and then you burn bits of the heart. But it's such an intricate procedure because you've got to realize these cardiologists are working in two-dimensional pictures in a three-dimensional field. So they've really got to be very expert how they maneuver the catheters and then just burn little bits of the electrical system in the heart to put someone back into a good rhythm. Or if they're getting recurrent bouts of fibrillation, that's when you do it. But I just think once you get over the age of 65, stay with the medications if you can.
I was thinking, not putting aside the skills involved in doing this, what about the skills involved in saying it?
Oh, well, that's what happens with years of training. You get to say them pretty easy, but I can tell you, I've never done any of these techniques because I'm not an interventional cardiologist, but it takes a lot of time, a lot of patience and a lot of effort to do these things and skill to do these things very well.
Okay, a recent study suggests that eating foods rich in flavonoids like berries and tea may lower the risk of dementia, and it may lower the risk of dementia by 28%, especially in those already at risk. Now, the study followed nearly 122,000 adults, and it found that those who consumed more flavonoids-rich foods had better brain health over time.
Yeah, this is a really good study. Again, from the UK Biobank, though we just mentioned that before in the anaesthesia study. And just very simple messages we give all the time. You think, well, hang on, dementia is just a disease you can do nothing about. Well, that's just not true. And it's a bit like paying insurance. You might claim on the insurance now, but you may need it later on. And people in their middle age to more advanced years before they get very old, the more you look after yourself as a younger person, the better off you are when you're an older person. So people who practice the walk of five keys to being healthy, no addictions, good sleep, good eating and less of it, 3 to 5 hours of exercise, which reduces your risk for dementia by 30%, by the way, and happiness, those five things together reduce your risk for all diseases 70 to 80%. So this particular study focused on people's flavonoid intake. So flavonoids are a particular part of the polyphenol chemicals, which just basically mean plant chemicals. And the flavonoids are, as you say, berries, tea, red wine, dark chocolate. And they're just some examples, but all fruits and vegetables have a degree of flavonoids in them anyhow. And the more you consume these things, the better off you are. So they found people that had 6 servings a day of flavonoids had the 28% reduction. But people who had the higher genetic risk, so there's a particular blood test called an ApoE allele, and if you've got one copy of the ApoE4 allele, because there are 3 different types, ApoE2, ApoE33, which is the common one, ApoE43 or 44, if you're 43, your risk is so much higher. If you have the flavonoids, you reduce your risk by 43%. If you've got high blood pressure, you reduce your risk by 30%. And if you've got depression, you reduce your risk by 48% by having the flavonoids. Now, Chris Hemsworth, that wonderful actor, he has come out relatively recently and said, I've just been detected that I've got 2 copies of the ApoE44 gene. So he really needs to work on his lifestyle now to make sure when he gets older, it doesn't cause him any issues.
A recent study from the University of Canterbury discovered that using cannabis during pregnancy is linked to genetic changes in babies that could negatively affect brain development. Now, this is the first time researchers have shown a direct connection between prenatal cannabis exposure and scientific genetic changes, Ross.
You see, this gets to the more widespread topic of health being pre-cradle to the grave. And there's been some really striking studies over the years, one called the Dutch Hunger Winter and another one called the Overcalix Study, where they looked at the effects of diet, of exercise, of lifestyle on the children and grandchildren of people. So, for example, the Dutch Hunger Winter was during the Nazi occupation of Holland. They cut off the food supply to, I think it was the northwest part of Holland, and people had incredible famine. Many people died because of this. But when they looked at the children and grandchildren of these people, there was a marked increase in cardiovascular disease and diabetes in these people. So what we're saying is that how you treat yourself even before you get pregnant, male or female, may have an effect on your child, not just acutely and with their growth in utero, but as they grow. And this study looked at the molecular signature for neurodevelopment, brain development, and neurodegenerative diseases at birth at age 7, 15 to 17 and 27 for the children of mothers that used medical cannabis. And here's the problem. A lot of young women might use cannabis, and I don't agree with anyone smoking cannabis, but they don't even think they're getting pregnant. They don't even know they're pregnant for 8 to 12 weeks after they get pregnant, and they're still smoking cannabis. Now, what this is saying is this is quite dangerous for your unborn child. So if you're thinking of pregnancy or you're a young woman who may be in a sexual relationship with someone else where you're not using protection, please don't smoke cannabis, because the potential damage to your child is quite enormous. And even a male that smokes one joint a week, if he then gets his partner pregnant, that unborn child can have a marked increase in congenital abnormalities. Look, I'm a great believer in medical cannabis, different thing, but smoked cannabis is just so dangerous.
All right, Ross, thanks, mate. It's always great to talk to you. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Okay, talk to you next week. Hello, mate.